like, you need to find someone that you can ask questions, like, and wrong questions, and you won't be penalized for it, because otherwise you can't grow if you're always just trying to be right all the time.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Data Scientist Show. Today, we have Pauline Chow. Pauline is a data scientist and former legal attorney and active transportation advocate. She worked in banking, fashion, and education startups and Amazon. Currently, she is the data engineering lead for Threco, a blockchain research and modeling company. She has a master's degree in computer science, machine learning from Georgia Institute of Technology. She has a law degree from the University of Wisconsin. She is a certified yoga teacher and published writer. You can read her published stories at paulinechowstories.com. While she was a senior data scientist at Amazon, she has worked across teams in HR, devices, real estate, and today we'll talk about how she tackled different problems in different domains of data science and her career journey. And if you have been enjoying the show, give me a five-star review and subscribe to the channel. Welcome to the Data Scientist Show, Pauline.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be talking to you today.
So how did you get into data science?
I think from the start, I've been reading this book called The Four Tendencies, and I realize I'm a questioner. So I'd like to ask questions, and not all questioners become data scientists, but it's a very, very good career, I think, because it helps you formulate your questions and then use data to find your solutions. I think probably a lot of attorneys are questioners too. But when I was younger, I got interested in computer science, which was pretty rare at the time. It was a lot of years ago. I learned programming in high school and then got into statistics. But because I had this like very idealistic way about the world, I thought that, you know, I should become like a public attorney, which I did. Mm-hmm. So from that, I had some skills, like I think like, you know, with technology and then I thought that I should be using it at some point. And as an attorney, I was helping people within one system, but I wasn't really learning anything outside of that system. So I got kind of curious as to like what other things I could be doing with my life. So then I switched back to data science and working with data.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so quite an interesting journey. I definitely want to talk more about how your experiences in law helped you with your data science project. So in Amazon, what was your first team and your first project?
My first team with Amazon was with the devices team, mm-hmm. working with about, I think, 20 economists looking at different questions the business had about devices, of new devices, the current performance of existing devices at the time. So that was 5 years ago. I think like that's when Echo was kind of like the newest thing. And then figuring out what else the market wanted in terms of like voice, technology, and functionality.
In the device team, you mentioned you're working with economists. Can you tell us, share us more about what was the problem you're trying to solve and what was the data science element you contributed?
Oh yeah, so then I think that team was really interesting because it's the first time I worked with so many economists. They do have some interesting ways to translate small data into like larger data questions. So using surveys and those type of responses and constructing like a Markov decision chain with those to simulate kind of wants and needs, and then translating that into like a business solution. So for devices, it was around the features that people wanted. Mm-hmm. And then I think designing the survey was, I think, the most important component of that process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you, in our previous chat, you talked about measuring the ecosystem of customer contact to determine the values of actions on propensity. Can you tell us more about the project?
Oh yeah. So this, just to finish off, this survey type of process is interesting because it measures like desire and propensity. And the thing with that is it's trying to measure something that doesn't already exist.
Yeah.
Right. So then, you know, how does someone know, like before, you know, like Alexa and Siri, how does someone know they want this when they've never experienced it before? I mean, sci-fi movies help, which I think that's why there's like some connection with me and like writing speculative and fantasy. Because then being a data scientist in this type of area requires you to look to the future. So then the only thing you can do is make up your own stories about what the future looks like.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of data scientists have to do that. You have to like create a story for yourself. So you can kind of take the world and distill it into like a model.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times they're like, you know, 2D, 3D models and not all the dimensions that you need. So just the same, the survey is you're crafting your world into like a list of 10 questions. And then the question that the project you're talking about that I mentioned is actually based off of history, because Amazon and like a lot of maybe companies who have a lot of data about customers, you're able to kind of measure the relative impact of an action by that customer.
Yeah.
Over many, many years. So I think that's, you know, definitely that's a positive to working at a company like Amazon, who's had such a like long lifespan with their customers. So just think of me, I registered for Amazon when I was before law school. So then I can see all the like law school books that I bought and kind of like my interest in books at different times in my life. But then I also, you know, I bought a house when I bought stuff from Amazon. I like got married. I registered myself on there. So basically you can look at everybody who kind of like are similar, right? Age and education, because they don't have that data, but they could buy it. So they can enhance your data as much as they want. So then you can find, you know, and with like a lot of different clustering methods or just similarity, very basic similarity measures, find out who's similar and then kind of compare those people. So, if someone gets married, like how much more money do they spend on Amazon if they don't get married? So based on that policy, you know, like that action, people might be like, Amazon should support, you know, more marriage because they make more money. You know, it's kind of, you know, not, they don't do that, but I'm just saying. Yeah. And then kids, you know, like if you have kids, like how much money do you spend on Amazon versus not? You know, so you can use techniques to do that because you have so much data, then your clustering and your similarities become really interesting. And then you can track people as groups and then measure actions with money, with like quantity. It's like, oh yeah, if you get married, you for the rest of your life, you spend, let's say like 50% more than anyone else. I'm making this up.
Yeah.
But it's something along that lines. So then now you have an idea of behaviors you might want to influence as a company.
Got it. Yeah, that sounds very interesting. It seems like you need to come up with a lot of assumptions and then try to verify the assumption or test assumption from the data, whether it's true or not, and find a story there. And also through the survey, asking sometimes an open question. So you mentioned there are some techniques to do that. One is clustering. What are some other commonly used statistical method or maybe machine learning or maybe analytics that are used in this process?
Oh, yeah. So that's a great question. I think One thing that a lot of product companies use is, including Amazon, I think, is like network analysis. Mm-hmm. So it's also another way of structuring your data, not as a column and row.
Yeah.
And I personally really like using networks because you can look at additional connections. You can look at, yeah, the relationship of products and people, and then, you know, who uses them and mm-hmm. when. And then so when I say who uses them, it's now I'm still talking about when you have really large data set of people's actions and behaviors and, you know, places in their lives. So I think that's very useful for enhancing the data that you already have.
Yeah. And so when you say network analysis, how do you do network analysis? Can you just give us a quick overview? For example, I haven't done any analysis using that method.
Oh yeah. So so instead of everything being a column and a row, it's you can do it directed or undirected. So you care about what direction things go in. Mm-hmm. For instance, if you had you had like a feedback tool where someone could say something good about you and you can say something good about them, then you become, you know, like a point, and then that person becomes a point. And then so from that point, you can also enhance kind of that connection and you know, put a value on it or mm-hmm. put like the number of times you guys connected in the system.
Yeah.
And then all your data points become the connections. So A to B, B to C, C back to A. So like your data becomes rows of these connections. After you have a connection, you sort of have a map that you can use some kind of interesting algorithms to look at. You can look at the shortest path from one point to another, how many points are connected to a certain specific dot. And then after that, there's also the more famous use of kind of like a network loosely is the PageRank algorithm, which is what Google uses for search. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of like probabilistically how people move through the network based off of the size or the quality of the connection.
Yeah. Oh, that's very interesting. Thanks for sharing that. So you construct the roles into the kind of the relationship between each dots, each like units of your interest. So what was the data size really big in that project? How did you handle the big data problem?
Oh yeah, in devices it was a very large data set. So the big data problems versus when I worked in like real estate, it's like a small data problem. And then to a lesser extent in employee data, it's like the problem there, I don't know if there's an official name for it, but it's like a pretty large, you know, robust data set, but it doesn't move very often. Like you don't get additional data points very often for employees in like an HR space. But so back to devices, I think it depends what the problem was. So because the good thing, because like a lot of scientists and economists have worked out that the patterns that we saw at Amazon could be looked at a high level. Mm-hmm. And also because it is like, there's so many data points that, that you could look at people and business measures with like general metrics, like a median at Amazon for like how many people bought this product is different in like, you know, smaller company maybe or a smaller data set. I think a lot of businesses relied on metrics, like pretty straightforward metrics, but I think that's why they had a lot of BIEs and data analysts to create their WBRs. I haven't said that in a long time.
WBR is the weekly business review.
Yeah, they had WBRs, MBRs, QBRs. Mm-hmm. So then they could, you know, kind of track the trends and make sure there's kind of nothing. There's like they would pay attention to the outliers essentially, because I think at that point that's what you care about is like outliers, because you already have like your trend established. Mm-hmm. So yeah, with the big data problem, it was you know, using the right tools so you can scale. Mm-hmm. And then consistency and automation would be kind of the kind of like big picture solutions to big data problems. Yeah. And I think also when you have big data, then you can focus on simplicity of the process and just assume simplicity unless you have to branch out of that. So then that was a good, really good place for, I think, like the economist way of thinking, economist type of modeling, because, you know, like linear regression usually could solve the problem like 80 or 90% of the time.
Yeah. And so previously you talked about big data using the right tools can be very useful. So for example, what are some tools that you find very helpful for those cases you have worked on?
Yeah, so it depends kind of, you know, obviously what you're doing. I think for the roles that I were in that I had to communicate a lot with the business, I actually really liked Amazon's like different flavors of SQL that they've created, because I think it went on the teams that I worked on, even the less technical people could read SQL.
Yeah.
So then it like removed a communication issue. And then some of the tools that are created, like for instance, I think and anyone can use now if they pay for it, like Athena to S3. And the reason I call that out is because it's a setting where you can give a business user a login to the AWS console. They can go to Athena, you can save your SQL, and then they can just run it and just change. And then if they need to, like just change a date, change like the name of the product, and then kind of have this self-service relationship with them in terms of data and whatnot. But obviously, you know, it takes for the data person takes a while for you to kind of work out the logic, clean the data, get it to a certain point. And then I really appreciated all these tools that internally Amazon had created to automate creation of data sets.
Yeah. And I really like what you mentioned about the simplicity on big data. I think sometimes when we have a lot of data, we think that, oh, we have to use a very complicated model to find a solution. But sometimes simple model works, especially in the context of device. When working with economists, you want to be able to interpret the results. So some simple models like linear solutions, you can really understand the coefficients. What are some other ways you can simplify your data science approach when dealing with big data, or maybe some other examples when you're on that team?
I think looking at the metrics that you're using, like, and the features that you're using is very important. I think, you know, even just playing around with, you know, averages, medians, percentiles is important, and in creating models based off of those. And then I think there are some nuances with, like, you know, for instance, if we looked at customer behavior, you want to make sure you're, you know, taking into account seasonality, holidays, depending on what you need, and then do the right smoothing for it. Like you can do, you know, 90 days, 60 days, even a year smoothing. And it essentially takes out the question of like seasonality. If everything is like all of your metrics are over the year.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, just using data and features to simplify the questions and try to take out as many confounding elements as possible.
Mm-hmm. So how do you take out the confounding elements? I think sometimes that's hard to detect the confounding effect.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a one solution for that. It's kind of what the problem is that you're faced with. I think in real estate, it was a lot of it was seasonality, because if you're looking for like a site that you want to put a store in, mm-hmm. and you look at previous behavior, then a lot of that was a lot of activity is based off of, you know, holidays and when people have time off and whatnot. So just creating features and assumptions that you think are like equal to each other. And then also, you know, using statistics to figure out, you know, what things are most correlated and trying to figure out, kind of the distribution of each of the features that you're using and being able to understand in a story, but also through statistics, like what it means to combine the different features.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you mentioned, so you do a lot of, feature engineering, and you enjoy the engineering part of the work. So if you do think about like a breakdown of time, how much of it was working on feature engineering or building data pipelines, and how much of it was doing data modeling work?
Oh, yeah. So I think it depends too on which team you join in Amazon, because there are teams that you like a jack of all trades data scientist, where you work with the data and you all build some models and, you know, and you write the papers.
Yeah.
Right. But then there are some teams where you only write the papers and you ask for data sets from the data engineering team, and then the data engineering team hands those to you. Mm-hmm. Right. So then I always liked being on a team where you kind of had to do more variety. So then, yeah, I would say like, you know, at least 60% of my time was with the data. And then another 10 or 20% was, you know, talking to the business. Mm-hmm. And then the last 20% would be like the modeling.
Yeah. So when you say with the data, is more like data understanding, like you mentioned, look at some distribution outlier, think about mm-hmm. feature engineering. And yeah. I think a lot of times when people think about data scientist work, people just think about the modeling part. But I think majority part is, like you mentioned, with the data. It can include a lot of things, either building pipelines or understanding the domain knowledge behind the data. And that might not sound as sexy as building a machine learning model, but I think that's very important. And that can also be very fun. Like you mentioned, you're discovering the story behind that. And if you don't understand your data, you would not be able to provide generate a high quality model with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, and it's also kind of figuring, you know, within your career is like figuring out like, you know, what you enjoy, what you're kind of better at. Mm-hmm. And then, but then also allowing yourself kind of a little bit space to learn a little bit more. So it's like who you work with, like, are the people that you work with supportive of you extending yourself? Because I think there are teams like and companies where they, you know, they just want you to come in and just like, you know, just do all the work, but then not concerned with like your interest, whether or not like you're engaged. Because not everyone wants to do something outside of their wheelhouse.
Yeah.
But if you do, then you should find a team that's supportive of that and that you can learn from them. So it's kind of like learning your style and kind of being on the right team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. So I also been on probably 4 or 5 different teams in Amazon. I think that's the one benefit of working in a large company. You have mm-hmm. different type of options of teams. And I think also I know the data scientists, for example, in Facebook or other maybe social media related company, they're very specific, focusing on product analytics. And then there's machine learning engineering only working on machine learning related work. I think in Amazon, we also have applied scientists doing more machine learning. But the data scientists, people ask me, what do data scientists at Amazon do? I think it's really depends on the team. We don't really have a specific type of task assigned to us. So I think that's the fun part of it. And if you look at the internal guidelines for like promotion, there's nothing about, oh, you have to know this modeling technique or you have to code in certain languages to be promoted to the next level. It's all about the influence you have on your team, or whether you are expert in a specific domain, but it's up to your background and then also the team. So yeah, thanks for also sharing your experience on that. I definitely want to talk more about finding your passion and finding a team later. But I think previously you mentioned some project in realistic. I'm curious if you can share more about what type of problem you were solving there. It seems like there's a shift from kind of big data to like a smaller data set.
Yeah, well, in the smaller data set space, you have to rely a little bit more on statistics and like the way that the assumptions that you're going to put in the model, like each feature is really, really important. And then also like, I guess the outcome, the output, the deliverable is important, but also there should be understanding that it's like, it's a representation, like versus it. It's like a representation of like relatively of what you think will happen. And it's not a prediction, you know, can't really, I guess like prediction is more like, it's like a, I don't know, you can say it's a better guess, but I think sometimes in people who maybe are not technical, they think a prediction is like 100% or it's like magic. It's like a prophecy, which it's obviously not. It's just more like, it's just like a gauge of kind of what you think the future might be.
Yeah. And this is always a probability. Nothing is 100%. I think it's also data science's job to explain, sometimes to educate people, what does the number mean in the report and how much certainty you can take. So what are can you give us some example of what are some more specific projects you worked on in the real estate team?
Yeah, well, the real estate team, the team that I worked on, it was the bookstores team, which doesn't exist anymore. The Amazon shut down bookstores. I think a couple of weeks after I left that team and like went to this new company, they decided to close all bookstores.
They're like, we don't have Pauline anymore. We have to shut down.
I'm gonna think that now. Thank you. But yeah, so it was interesting because I think Amazon had dealt with a lot of, you know, ephemeral space, like things that you can change very easily, like a website, e-commerce. But then they do have a branch of real estate, which has it doesn't allow a lot of experimentation. So they, you know, Amazon also owns Whole Foods and they also have Amazon Fresh, I think, and some other, and Go as well for groceries. And then this team, I was on this team like right around when the pandemic hit. And then they were, you know, kind of struggling through the pandemic. And then you know, the team was monitoring like, whether things were returning back to normal in terms of foot traffic.
Yeah.
But then there are also things like they found I looked in the data, like a lot of people moved from, there's a couple stores that had a lot more drop in traffic relative to other ones. And it's because people moved to other places. And so then there's a lot of uncertainty in that, but it was taking the stores that they had, which was a very small number. I think it was like, I forgot, there's like 24 stores. And then using that, their activity and transactional history to figure out what similar sites would perform better or worse. Than the stores that they had.
Yeah. So when you have a very small sample size, how do you perform those analysis? What are some methodology you used?
Oh yeah, yeah. I think it's just communicating to people what it means, what the outputs means. Mm-hmm. Certain types of testing, like we used leave one out, and
What's the name of the test?
Oh yeah, so instead, crossfold validation, where you take a portion of the data and use a test and train, but then you split your entire data set up that way. Mm-hmm. Where it's like 80-20, 20 is your test, 80 is your train, but you can split the data set that way up to like five times, right?
Right.
So like, and so instead of, it'd be instead of 80-20, I mean, essentially you just leave out one store. You just take out one store, run the model on 23.
Oh, so instead of doing like those type of cross validation, when you have large data set, you're doing just leave one out.
Yeah.
So one is like, oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's just like how you test and train the model is that's basically the only way you can have like a robust idea of what your model can understand. And then I think there was a lot of like deep diving into the variations that came out, like are the error rates or the predictions, how much error is within each run, and then kind of like deep diving. And then I think some of the results was, we did take out like one or two stores because it was like over representing the prediction for a revenue. So it's like, very detailed work into the data set that you have. And it's also relying on other metrics that you can get. I think I also incorporated some features like proximity to other stores that were useful,
mm-hmm.
that were impactful to the model.
Yeah.
And then so like getting a data set on how much a customer is spending somewhere else or a relative, and then figuring out if there's like a categories of stores that lifted the sales for a particular store, and generally across all the stores that you're trying to measure. I think, and then so the algorithm that we used ended up just being a ranking algorithm. So based off of what the real estate agents were interested in, they would enter a list of sites, and then the output would be a rank. So then, because of the limited accuracy of this model, then that was the best we could produce for them, I think. So, yeah. So it's also not like being overly confident in what you can produce was important too, because it was so limited.
Yeah. So I would say sometimes you don't know whether how the model will represent the real world, but it's still better than just making a guess. And now after you communicate with the business, or when someone make a decision where to launch a bookstore, so how do you bring that feedback back to evaluate your model, or whether my prediction was good? Like, how do you close the loop to evaluate the results?
I think we would do like quarterly, and I was on the team for like maybe a year. And then for a lot of that year, the stores were closed,
mm-hmm.
and nothing was opening. So I think that the team did have like a history of updating their models every 3 months.
Yeah.
With new sample mm-hmm. size, like adding one or two stores, and then kind of just reevaluating their assumptions.
Yeah.
Because it turned out that model turned out to be, a three feature model. Mm-hmm. And then I added like one feature, which is like proximity to a type of store.
Yeah.
That was appropriate for that particular retail space. But then in that space, you can't have too many features that you're using.
Yeah, especially when your data is small, when you have more features, it just adds more noise to the model. Mm-hmm. And so you also worked with like location, kind of geospatial data. Is it the same project you mentioned? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was. So in real estate, the features, the 3 to 4 features we had were based off of geographical data. So then it's how you draw it. It was represented as a point, so like 2D. But mm-hmm. then to extract these features, there were some assumptions and metrics and analysis that went into deciding what points, like which points to use, and then maybe how to draw the centroid, or even how to draw a polygon to extract that data.
Mm.
Because, you know, for instance, if you have like a site in a mall versus a site that you want to put in, like, you know, in a parking lot,
mm-hmm.
like how do you compare traffic from any of those points together? So it's like deciding how you draw the area. Mm-hmm. And then from the data we had, sometimes, you know, had like, for instance, a mile from a point, 5 yeah. miles, 6 miles or whatever. And then you have to draw the area differently given maybe like what area you're in, like rural, suburban. So you can do some smoothing in the data before the model. So it's kind of similar when I mentioned, like, if you use a feature where it's like lagging over a year, then you kind of smooth out the seasonality. In this case, you can smooth out features by deciding how to draw comparable polygons or distances around a particular point.
Yeah, that sounds very interesting. Thanks for sharing that. So you are also using computer vision to evaluate the site surroundings. Can you tell us more about that?
Oh man, I have to look back at my code. I don't remember anymore.
Yeah.
But it really was. I think my main challenge was getting the right photographs.
Mm.
So there was Google Street View, but you can't use it for commercial unless you're Google. So there, you know, we looked into some free sources, which only had like partial amount of data. I think one of the POC, we used the pictures from the real estate people, because they have to take pictures when they go to site visits. But we were trying to find like a scalable way to get photographs. I think one use case, which I didn't end up, you know, following through all the way because it wasn't there anymore, is trying to figure out if you can put cameras on like Amazon delivery trucks to take pictures of the street. But the problem is, you know, not all sites that you want to evaluate are popular enough for delivery trucks to pass.
Yeah.
So you would have to develop a system where you like enter the address in somewhere, and then someone figures out who's going to deliver the closest to that point, and then ask them to kind of, you know, do a detour.
Hmm.
But like, you know, that was kind of one of the ideas we floated around there, but we didn't get past the POC for that.
Before we change topic, are there other interesting projects in the device team or the real estate team that you want to share with us?
I think you covered a lot of it. Yeah, mm-hmm. I think that was a lot of more interesting things, minus some, you know, the day-to-day annoyances, you know, when you know, the script that you ran yesterday, you come mm-hmm. to work and it doesn't work, and then you spend like half a day fixing it, you know, so things like that, you know, that the non-glamorous stuff that's like part of our jobs. I think you covered the more glamorous parts of my
job. I have similar experiences. Sometimes when you're on the new project, you have to get access to a new database, get the permission. Yeah. So that can last for a few days or sometimes a few weeks. And then when you finally have access, you're approaching the delivery date of your project. You only have 2 or 3 days to quickly do your model and do the evaluation and think about the how to production your solution. So yeah, that's just the data scientist life.
Now I remember, permissionings was pretty hardcore. But I think, Amazon tried to make headway into it. Like a lot of the IAM or kind of
IAM roles in AWS.
Yeah, I think it's a kind of based off of, some internal systems they have and like in the pain that you have to deal with like putting people in, but then also when they leave, taking them off or also like a lot of times it was like someone left the company, but then they didn't do anything with the permission. So then like the permissions get like forwarded to some random person. And then that person's trying to figure out how to like get rid of it because they don't want to deal with it anymore.
Right. Yeah. So what are some cool projects you worked in HR? I also worked in HR, by the way. So curious to see what you worked on. Maybe we can also compare some notes.
I do want to hear what you worked on.
Yeah,
I worked on some interesting things. I think I wanted to learn about for a company like Amazon, or big company, what are they looking at?
Mm-hmm.
For people and then I touched on some labor issues when I was an attorney. So then I also thought there's some interesting overlap with that because some of it is, I think the DEI kind of in more interest in that within tech companies has been a interesting boon for HR because then it's an initiative where it requires the company to be more proactive about what they're doing and in terms of and what they're not doing for employees. So they study trends of who left, who stayed after certain milestones. And then they obviously cared about tenure of people. And then also they did a few surveys in the year. I think every year they did a tech survey that was a pretty, I guess, big deal within the tech space and asked about how you were enjoying and your work at Amazon. And so I think a lot of leaders use that to determine what they're doing. Amazon also used connections.
Mm-hmm.
And we incorporated those as features into different things we're doing.
To interrupt, just for the folks who are not familiar with the terms we're talking about. So Amazon Connection is a daily survey, a pop-up. So when you open your laptop, there will be questions like, are you happy with your manager? Do you like your job? Are you going to leave the team and stuff like that? So those things are called connections. Yeah, sorry. Keep going.
Yeah. So totally. Thanks for explaining. So then I as an employee, when in HR and out of HR before, before and after they use connections, they actually had data for managers who were perceived by their employees as not doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
They told managers, at least my managers did this too. They would review connection scores with you.
Yeah. Right. We do that too. Yeah. I think you have to do that for every team. And then it's part of the performance review for the managers. They need to maintain a certain level of mm-hmm. score, maybe the company average mean, I don't know.
Yeah. That's what it seemed like. So the good part of that was they use data as a tool to influence behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So then I thought that was kind of a good initiative by HR leaders to use data to communicate something to a leader.
Yeah. You also talked about network effects of employee feedback. So can you tell us more about that?
Oh yeah, I did a POC to look at this. There's this one review cycle, and it wasn't for promotion. It was a way for, I think, I'm just extrapolating, but because it was like the whole point of the system was to talk about your superpowers. I think it was called, yeah, it was called Forte, I think.
Yeah, it's our annual review name. Yeah.
Yeah, no, but I mean, I think HR was like, oh, there used to be annual review, but then they're like, this is not a replacement for annual review. It was like different. But then just using that data set to look at kind of the idea of different types of players in a team or organization. So because there's some really interesting, I will send you the link. There's some, you know, like labor economists that have a theory that like top performers are not the ones that hold the organization together. Top performers don't always make the team better. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to figure out a process using like network analysis and some sample data sources to determine if like you can find out who is like a network player, and in network analysis you can call them a hub or like a highly rated highly weighed centroid in the system, and to figure out if that correlated with high performers. And then if they didn't, then could we create a system to reward people who are these, you know, centers of information and important people, but not in like the traditional corporate sense.
Yeah. Oh, that's very interesting. So does it mean this individual is the person that a lot of people will ask them for help, for questions, for opinion? So this is like someone who really influenced the team.
Yeah. Like, I mean, I had like, you know, obviously limited assumptions that I can make in the data set that I use, because I used a data set that like everyone knew that was available to, mm-hmm. for the company to view. Yeah, so you're right on point. If there was somebody who was, someone asked for feedback pretty often, which means that person worked with more people. And then whether that person like worked across teams or just on their own team, and kind of, I think there's a theory where like if somebody is like working outside their team a lot, they're bringing a lot of like external knowledge to their team and doing a lot of the connections that are required for, you know, like permissioning and like analysis that other parts of their team are doing. So yeah, that's definitely one feature that I looked at in terms of importance in the network.
Mm-hmm. And when you say the network analysis, is it a similar analysis you use in the device team that you mentioned, looking at the relationships of the people?
Yeah, it's the same like technique, mm-hmm. Code, but with like different types of assumptions, mm-hmm. and players.
Yeah, that's really cool. I feel like if you have a few things in your toolbox, it doesn't really matter what is the context, what is the domain knowledge. I think that's a cool part about being a data scientist. You can literally work in any domain. And also in Amazon, like you mentioned, those businesses are actually very different. It feels like, and also the culture are also slightly different, although we all have the same promotion process. Sometimes it does feel like I'm working in the different industry within the company. And let me know if you can share the previous report you were mentioning, the labor from the experts.
I'll send you the link to, I think it's, I remember I like, it was a paper, and then it might've been like a YouTube link. I'll, mm-hmm. send it to you.
Yeah.
But what did you work on in HR?
Yeah. So I worked on a project that was fairly new. At that time, they were having in-person trainings for solution architects. So in Amazon, solution architect will work with AWS customers to help them develop their projects using AWS tools. And the shift is they want to provide digital training to the solution architect, and they want to evaluate how good this training is compared to the previous training. And they want to implement different type of checkpoints throughout the digital training to see whether we can evaluate whether a learner has learned something. So we use a lot of Bayesian method in this project because when you are learning something online, there will be quizzes. And for example, when someone asks you a question, maybe you don't know it, but you guessed the answer. And maybe you know the answer, but somehow you clicked the wrong choice. And so how do we come up with the base rate, the assumptions for those distribution, and use all of that to evaluate, okay, based on this person's response to the quizzes, whether this person has really learned the course, or do this person need to give it another chance? You have a failed exam. So it's very interesting. You need to think about not just a lot of literatures around students in high school or college, but there hasn't been a lot of literature about the learning behavior for adults, especially for tech professionals. So the challenge would be, we don't have those type of priors. How do we construct those things? And we also want to make sure this new online learning is not, the evaluation is neither too lenient or too strict, but to match the previous passing rate of the in-person training. So there's also a optimization problem around it. So how do you constrain those parameters in the Bayesian model to make sure this evaluation system is relatively moderate? So it was an interesting problem. And also the biggest challenge is it's a new product. So we don't have a lot of data. So we generate a lot of synthetic data. And I also stayed in a team. I think I stayed after the project was first launched in a small cohort. So we do have some feedback from the customer. But when we're developing the solution, we have to use synthetic data, do a lot of a simulation. I think sometimes you just don't have the real data, and it's not something you can buy from somewhere. And the data scientist's job is to, I think you mentioned, to think about the assumptions and to evaluate where are the different outcomes. It's like you're writing a story, a novel. You have different assumptions and they have different outcome, and then to communicate that to the stakeholders and mention that, hey, those are just my assumptions. In reality, it can be different. It's not magic. It's not 100%. But I think overall, the project was successful based on the small cohort we tested the model on. It seems like we have reduced the overall learning time people take when they try to go through this training, and remained a similar kind of pass rate to the in-person training. So that was a very interesting project. I was always curious about, oh, who was looking at the connections, the daily service data. And it's very cool that you had used some of those data. And then I actually had connected with the principal data scientist. Her name is Andy Baker. She designed the connection surveys. So I also will have her on the podcast. So we'll talk more about how we design the surveys in Amazon and how to use survey data and machine learning to do people analytics. Yeah. So now we talked about your adventures in the three different teams, and also you have a background in law. So has those experience help you with your data science work?
Oh yeah, I think depending what kind of data scientist you want to be, I think understanding like human behavior or like and having some soft skills in terms of communication, like emotional intelligence is important. And yeah. obviously I'm not saying all lawyers have all this,
yeah.
but then, you know, it's just like, just increasing your contact with people definitely mm-hmm. kind of is a good experience in different contexts. Dealing with people in like very kind of emergency situations, because I did some family law, but I also did eviction defense mm-hmm. in California. So obviously those processes are really, really hard on everybody. So it's kind of, you know, understanding your own emotions and their emotions. When I worked in like public policy advocacy, I worked in talking to regional transportation agencies. So a lot of staff, but then also a lot of elected officials and then policymakers who determine how much money goes into like creating sidewalks and bike lanes versus highways. So then it's talking to people and then trying to work with them, trying to collaborate with them, trying to find like a frame of reference that you everyone can understand, you know, because I think in the policy role, it was there's a lot of different angles you can go with, like changing the allocation of funding. You can go like in a climate change route, but you know, if they're Republican or not a climate enthusiast, like that's like you don't talk about that. But then the organization I worked for was really focused on childhood obesity prevention. So that was usually like a good frame to put around. Mm-hmm. Increasing biking and walking to school, just for health of the community and health of children. And then that type of collaboration is different from like people who are like more environmentally focused. And then there was like a group of people who are just like super cyclists, but those were kind of like outliers. So then, but then you can kind of like bring everyone together on certain issues to kind of get things done. So I think that type of work really just put the stakeholder work, stakeholder management, which is, I think, is pretty core part of data science work as you move up. You know, I think if you're like, you know, entry level, you might not have a lot of stakeholder management, but as you move up, you definitely have to learn how to communicate and then use that information to filter the problems that you work on. And then, so then people perceive that you're like effective and that to a lesser extent that you are a problem solver. Mm-hmm. So I think I mentioned this book that I've been reading, The Four Tendencies, where I'm a questioner, but there's also another form of kind of responding to expectation is like you're an obliger. So I think like people who like obliging people externally. So if someone asks you to do something, an obliger will be much more motivated than like a rebel or like a questioner. So like, I think in a corporate setting, people want obligers, and not everyone is an obliger, but then you can kind of learn some skills about how to create a perception that you are solving people's problems and helping everybody kind of in this, like with some of these soft skills.
Yeah. So what are the four different types?
Okay. Well, the four tendencies, there's upholder, obliger, rebel, and questioner.
Mm.
So that's, it's an interesting construct that I'm like kind of looking at. It's like, it's not really based on personality, like INTJ. It's more like, how do people respond to internal expectations and external expectations?
Yeah.
So I think it's kind of fun sometimes to like, if you could understand like what your coworkers are,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can like work better together with like certain expectations. Like for instance, like an obliger, they might ask you, hey, can you help me? Can you nudge me? Mm-hmm. Like, can you like send me a reminder when I need to get it done?
Yeah.
Then like they're asking you for help. So you know, sending that extra email is like, would help them, you know, stay on course and things like that.
Yeah. Oh, cool. And a rebel probably will hate things like that.
Yeah. A rebel will like supposedly do, you know, they don't have external expectations or, mm-hmm. and they'll just, they have their own principles that they'll just like, they'll just go by their principles no matter what anyone else says.
Yeah.
So I think working with a rebel would be like identifying somebody's good traits and what they bring to the company and then letting them do what they need to and not applying too much pressure on them.
Yeah.
Because that will cause like the counter effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, thanks for sharing that. I think people are definitely more complicated than the dimensions of, you know, you mentioned Myers-Briggs or this four type, but I think it is helpful sometimes to have a framework to understand at a certain layer, especially on the professional settings, how to work with your colleagues. And if you don't know how to categorize them, you can just ask. I remember in my previous team in Amazon, I worked with a great manager and she would ask me questions in our very first one-on-one. She said, what is it like when you are grumpy? You know, how do you like to receive appreciation? Do you like to receive it in public or just throughout one-on-one? So I really appreciate it. I think sometimes maybe you can just, when the first time you collaborate with someone, could be your manager, could be your coworker, you can ask them, hey, what is the best way to work with you? Like, do you like to have a lot of meetings or work async? What is your preferred hours? Now we're all remote in different location and things like that.
Oh, yeah, that's a great point. That's awesome that your manager asked you that.
Yeah. I think those kind of understanding awareness about the people you work with, especially from different background from your previous experience as a lawyer, definitely helped your career in data science, or I think it's helpful for any type of career. And what are some specific about law that have helped your project? For example, your understanding of you know, data privacy laws and policies like GDPR. Those type of things.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think there, when I was at Amazon, there's a lot of projects that came up mm-hmm. with that angle. So I was able to like work with the frameworks that were put into place and also like suggest other frameworks and suggest ways to kind of merge like a technological definition of something that was written in a policy and interpretation is important. And now I'm working in a space with like blockchain and like smart contracts. And yeah. So that much has a very legal framework to it mm-hmm. too, in the smart contract type of approach. But there's, you know, a lot of smart contract developers who don't have a legal background, but so that's kind of where I can really kind of hone in on a specific area. I think being in legal, I think one thing is just asking questions and the right questions is, I think, was a very important skill to get.
Yeah. Are there any books you recommend to help us ask better questions?
That is good. That is a great question. I will think about that and send you something.
Yeah. I don't remember where I saw it, but I know, I think if you are doing a law degree, there's an entire semester just talking about things like framing. How do you frame things? And maybe it's a, you know, different program, but I think it's important for lawyers to understand how do you paint a picture? What are the assumptions out there? And different words, different language can completely change the perception of the case you present. And I think data scientists should also go through those type of trainings to understand how do you frame a problem. And maybe your framing could be different when you present to different stakeholders and audience, also for yourself to understand a problem. So yeah, just something that
yeah,
I
no,
thought
totally.
Of.
I think, yeah, totally. Like how you present the facts is really important. Mm-hmm. And then I think it's what also kind of separation of facts and law.
Yeah.
So law is kind of how you interpret the facts, right? So then mm-hmm. I think that separation has been important for me, like professionally, even personally a little bit, because then in a personal setting, you can take a step back and then like kind of tell yourself, to try to be as unbiased as you can with the facts, and then bring your own emotions into it later.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I think in previous, my interview with Nick Handel, we talked about it's important to have opinions as a data scientist, but it's also important to separate the facts and opinions when you present to people. Your opinions would be something similar to like your interpretation to the law, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And then so it also helps you tell you when your opinions are important. Because sometimes, you know, some things don't matter. Like, I think Amazon, I really like it. They use the two-way door, one-way door analogy. So if it's a two-way door, you can make the decision, but you can come back easily. If it's a one-way door, you basically make this decision and you basically have to start over if you want to go the other route. So kind of separating, you know, facts and emotions, or facts and logic, or whatever you're separating, it allows you to give you a little bit of space to say, okay, does my opinion matter here? And then to use your opinion effectively. Because if you have too many opinions, then your prior is like, you know, you're always giving opinions. But if you're selective about when you give it, then I think people might listen more.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. So can you tell us a little bit, what are you working on right now?
Oh yeah, right now I'm working with a team that is creating products for a few private clients in the blockchain space. So it's adopting different use cases for the blockchain and really diving into the kind of the protocol and the CS techniques that kind of make up unique blockchains. So crypto, we don't work directly in cryptocurrency, but cryptocurrency is obviously the most popular use case for blockchains. And so each different cryptocurrency leverages a different aspect of like the CS and math background of each of them. For like Bitcoin versus Ethereum, and then also Ethereum, it was on a, I think, proof of work. Now it's becoming proof of stake. So then, like, it's just like kind of different principles that are enacted to ensure like consistency, liveness, and like accuracy on this blockchain, which essentially is like a database. Mm-hmm. Blockchain is a certain type of database that is like, can be more trusted based off the principles that someone has designed it with. And so I'm really excited about this team because they are very technical. The CTO is a professor of math at USC. So then he brings a, you know, really specialized background that I can learn from a great deal. And so kind of, I leaned into more of my kind of data and software engineering interest there. So I can help these teams like unblock them and provide like a service that they need in this space, but also at the same time, learning a lot about blockchains and smart contracts.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. It sounds like a great industry and a great time to be in blockchain. And so previously you talked about understanding yourself and finding your voice. Can you share more about like how did you find your voice at work in your career?
I think everyone has to kind of go through this, and it's different people have to experiment against different ways. And my assumption is that's kind of linked to like how you grew up. Like if you're grew up and people are like, just be yourself and do whatever you want. Like, you know, you might potentially already have access to that, but then maybe some people haven't, you know, and then, or we've been too busy, like, you know, trying to, sometimes doing well in school means you're able to cater yourself to the situation. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, if teachers like say A, then you say A and you get a good score, then you know how to do that very well. But then now that when you're outside of that space and you have some room to either make your own decisions, like professionally or personally, that like no one's telling you how to get a good score. So then that's when you have to, I think, one, develop your own set of, you said frameworks or metrics or whatever you want to do, and like decide what is successful for you mm-hmm. and yourself, and not what you've learned in other places. And I think for like data scientists, like, you know, we usually go through a lot of schooling.
Yeah.
It could be sometimes difficult to have that framework already, but then I think, is this really like experimenting, like trying new things? But also as I do, like question how you define success. Mm-hmm. And then, cause then that's not all, what will always make you happy, but it could, you know, obviously a lot of people are probably happy with what they're doing. And then, yeah, this is like knowing that you can reinvent yourself. I think I've reinvented myself many times mm-hmm. and I continue to do it. I think it's fun, but it's also like my personality is like that.
Yeah. But, so for example, you become a certified yoga teacher and started writing. So how was that shift? How was that reinvent happened?
Oh yeah. So I think this is when I was like in my, after undergrad, I did the yoga teacher training because I thought, you know, I wanted to have a tool to teach myself and other people about, like, you know, I guess body awareness and like, and then also a different, yes, something that you're not taught in school, because like, I guess using your mind in different ways, like your school and like your, maybe your parents only teach you specific ways how to like, you know, use your mind as power. Kind of, you can like kind of sometimes make things happen, like with your own, like kind of with your own energy, with your own positive thinking, but also like, you know, like there's other principles like that people talk about, like grit mm-hmm. and like, you know, dealing with failure. So I think like having perspective, which in itself could be like physically, could be like meditation and yoga practices mm-hmm. that would help somebody. And I believe this help everyone take a step back, mm-hmm. you know, and then help you. I think it would help you emotionally and even like mentally, like we talked about, separate facts and law or facts and your emotions. Like it's a process that you train your mind to do, mm-hmm. like not just intellectually, but like kind of like, you know, metaphysically and also in ways you can't quantify, but although if you're a neuroscientist, you can probably mm-hmm. quantify.
Yeah.
The difference is, yeah. So then like, yeah, so I think it's like a helpful tool to have for just like well-being.
Yeah. And you also talked about different stages in your life and reinventing yourself kind of for like survival. I think in the earlier of our career, we all have this anxiety. Oh, am I doing good enough? Am I, you know, getting fired? How do I get to the next level? But then when you are at a certain level, for example, I think we were both senior data scientists at Amazon, but that's a stage where myself 5 years ago was thinking, oh, I'll be happy when I'm there and I will be so satisfied. But when I was there, there's a different type of kind of confusion in life that I have. And then I was like, oh, what's next? And I'm going to the next level. I don't know how you felt about it. And then, yeah, kind of curious about how do you optimize, find the metrics for happiness, and how do you see the levels in big companies?
I think it depends on the person, right? Like whether promotion will make you happy. Because mm-hmm. promotion is an institutional structure. So it's like school is institutional. It's like a structure to tell you you're doing a good job. But then who decides that you're doing a good job?
Yeah.
Right? So you kind of have to like, so I thought about like, do I care that I'm doing a good job? Like good job at Amazon is like, was doing more work, doing a lot of it, I think. And then to a reasonable extent, like doing higher quality work. But then the thing that I always found that it was the quantity of the work was always required there. And then sometimes, depending on the company, when you get promoted, you actually are expected to do more work or harder work. And I don't think everyone wants that. You know, like, so then it's kind of figuring out if like that's something that you want. And then also I found this weird thing. I don't know if you agree with this, but like, sometimes there's tricks to getting promoted. It's not like L4 to L5 to L6 in the same exact position. Like some people change job families, you know, like, and then get promoted a different way. And then I think in the SDE space, and so instead of being SDE 4, 5, 6, some people will go SDE and then TPM, mm-hmm. which is a technical product manager, mm-hmm. and then do SDM, which is mm-hmm. software development manager.
Yeah.
So they're not going up the IC route directly to a manager. They're mm-hmm. kind of taking a little bit roundabout way to do it.
Yeah.
And then one of the best managers I had at Amazon, he was like an English major, and then he did like vendor management, and then he was a BIE for a while, and he got like, you know, he went up the way of BIE, but then he jumped over to like product management, became like a leader through there. Because logistically for BIE, you can only get to like 7 and then it stopped. So you had to like, you have to jump ship somehow. But then I also think like having something that maybe you're interested in that's not necessarily rewarded the same way. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was like, I found out that how much I really like writing and expressing myself through fiction and then expressing ideas through fiction. Like, I like the work of collaborating with people and unblocking them with like a skill that I have. So like some data engineering and software skills. But then if I'm able to write every day, then like I'm happy.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And so now, how do you see you grow, whether as a writer or as a data engineering lead?
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Yeah. So then, yeah, totally. I think like my role is a little bit hybrid. So it's not like pure data engineering. So I do a little bit of data science, but that's not like what I'm, I guess, measured on. But I also like realized, that I like teaching. I did like some teaching at General Assembly in their data science program and analytics program. And so this particular company that I went to gave me management opportunities. Mm-hmm. So I have a team member now, and then I'm hiring another team member, also kind of in a hybrid role. And then management, part of it is managing a process, but also I in my opinion, like upskilling people.
Yeah.
So then they can achieve the next level. So I'm at a point where like I prefer to use my skills to like unblock people, what they're doing, but also upskill other people mm-hmm. and help them achieve their career dreams, because I don't necessarily, you know, like need to, and not all managers like this. I mean, I think I can move up as a manager better because I like the allocation of like people management and a little bit of like, you know, expertise in a particular area, but yeah. But I can like rely on a team for multiple people to like create a better solution together, instead of being the one person that is relied upon to create that one solution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that you're very good at understanding yourself. I think all those parts that you liked, it seems like you have done a lot of self-discovery through probably the books you mentioned, or just being very aware of the day and activity. Oh, do you enjoy this? Or how do you feel about those type of things? So thanks for sharing your experiences. So now you mentioned you have changed your career, maybe focus more on writing. So how do you measure your success now versus how you measured your success 5 years ago?
Yeah. I think that like, okay. So before Amazon, I feel like I had more also activities that I liked. I was like, really liked rock climbing. I've done that for like 15, 20 years. So I went outside in nature a lot when I lived in California. So I think a measure of my success was like, you know, how many hours I spent outside. I have a really good developer friend who she's an artist. So she like, she paints, you know? But then when I went to Amazon, I tried to like be, you know, I got sucked into the culture. So I kind of didn't have like, I didn't engage in like outside activity as much, you know, it was like really sucked into the culture. And I realized that wasn't me. So now it's like I said, like how many things I could do at work to unblock people. And then also obviously like some metrics, like how much data do we have, you know, how many data sets I can, you know, create for when, like based off of requests and things like that. And then it's also, I think for writers, you can either have like a writing goal by hour or by words. So then I really go by time, is like how much time do I spend? I try to spend like 1 or 2 hours a day working, like writing or just thinking about writing. And then I have some short stories that I've submitted to journals. Some of them were published, some of them are still pending. And then I'm working on a full length novel, and I've been working on it for like 4 years now. So eventually it'll be published.
Yeah.
It's a long game for mm-hmm. writing.
Yeah. And now looking back at your journey, what are some mistakes you have made in your career?
I think I relied on, this is a double-edged sword, because I think I relied on like institutions too much, like school, like degrees, mm-hmm. Maybe too much to pivot. I think I should have picked something that was allowed me more like a different life. So like, I think like engineering and like data science does like allow you to do like so many different things. So that like, that's definitely a good spot. Like law is really like constrictive, but at the time I like really thought I wanted to do like public policy work. So I got to do that. So I'm like, was very excited about it. But I think maybe I would have focused although I did have this idea as undergrad. I had a statistics undergrad, so that's kind of like very broad. So that's good. But then I think, I don't know if I would have gotten a law degree again.
Yeah.
But since I have it, there's value in it. Like right. I know the system. I like feel empowered in certain aspects. And then I do one day maybe expect to like go back into like more public law again, mm-hmm. maybe one day. But it's like, you know, like I dream about that, like all this stuff all the time. So I don't know.
What do you mean by public sector? Like what would you do in the public sector?
Oh yeah. You can work on a government, like in a government agency. I could do patent law probably if I wanted to, like for the patent department. Every agency has like their own lawyer. So it's like, there's a particular policy area you're interested, like consumer fraud or something like that. Mm-hmm. You can work there. I can also work like as a legal aid attorney, can work as like a public defender also.
Yeah. Cool. So who are someone who have inspired you or mentor you, and what are some best advice you got from them?
So yeah, one of my best bosses, my first boss at Amazon, he was we kind of had like a similar personality, but he's also really like honest with me. Yeah, and so he basically taught me all the secrets of like how, if you want to leave a team, like how you do it. Because there's a way that you do it. Like you don't
change teams in Amazon.
Yeah. Like he was really honest with me. He's like, this is how you do it. Don't do it the way that they tell you to.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and so, are you able to share like what did he tell you?
Yeah. But basically do everything informally. So like, you know, you do your
informal chat with the managers and then get a verbal offer before you apply. Yeah.
So because then it allows you room to experiment, you know, and mm-hmm. then like, if you don't get accepted on one team, it like, it's not part of your record.
Yeah.
You know? And so that was really good advice. I think he valued someone who was like, you know, jack of all trades type of thing. And so, and then the team that I was least happy on, that person did not appreciate that, you know? So it's kind of like, but then that manager, I was transferred, my manager like left and I got transferred to another manager.
Yeah.
So like, it kind of wasn't my choice, but then, it's kind of like knowing, evaluating your manager in that way. Like, do they appreciate me? Like, not personally, but just like, what kind of person do they want on the team? And I clearly wasn't that type of person. So like, you know, I knew after I got transferred to that person, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm probably going to leave this team or Amazon, like from this team. Yeah. So the best advice I usually get is like honest advice, and I can like, you know, feel the authenticity from that advice. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
And then, so then that's how I give advice too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so now say if you're mentoring a data scientist, what is your best advice for them?
My best advice for a data scientist and like working with them is kind of showing your work. It's like kind of feel open to like making mistakes. But the caveat is you have to work with someone that you're okay with making mistakes. And so that might not be your manager. That could be like a colleague. You need to find someone that you can ask questions like and wrong questions, and you won't be penalized for it, because, you know, otherwise you can't grow if you're always just trying to be right all the time.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And what about like for someone's career in general, what are some of your advice for them to discover themselves and find happiness and find a, you know, work-life balance?
Yeah, I think it's setting your boundaries just for what works for you, and then finding someone or an employer that will fit that. I mean, we're lucky in data science because right now it's pretty still highly sought after. So you could choose to a certain extent, or, you know, or if you can't choose, then you hopefully have like some sort of exit plan if the environment is toxic or it doesn't live up to your current standards. So like you can keep looking. I think that's good. That's like a good thing to look at. And I think it's always good, I think, not to have all your experience in one place or in one sector. You know, like even if you stay at the same company, definitely try to vary what you look at and vary who you know at the company too. So you can get some more perspective.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that. And before we wrap up, what is something that you're excited about in your life or in your career right now?
I'm excited about working on these like really interesting like problems at work. Eventually I hope I can share it with you, but then it's like, it's, you know, working with some of these research scientists, I'm like really amazed at the solutions they come up with. And then they ask me for data or some sort of other support for it. So I'm like really excited to be part of those like ideas, those new ideas. I think also I'm excited to share like my story eventually. I'm like rewriting it again, but you know, every rewrite I'm like, oh, this one's it, you know? So I think this one's it, but you know,
yeah.
Who knows?
Also curious, now you moved to the data engineering role, but you have a degree in like statistics, machine learning previously. Also, I know you worked a lot with data, but also the modeling. Do you miss working on the modeling part?
No, I don't necessarily miss it, but in my current role, it is a little hybrid. So I do interact with the simulation that this company has created. And so I have to understand it to test it mm-hmm. and to feed data into it yeah. and then to like analyze the outputs. So I do have to use all that knowledge that I had before. Mm-hmm. It's just like in a slightly different way. And it's also because I know that like the research scientists working on this problem, like they're better at solving this problem than me. So,
yeah.
So then, so I feel like I'm hopefully absorbing their intelligence somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
So yeah, I'm pretty psyched about that.
Yeah. And for people who want to follow your journey in the future or your writing, where can they find you online?
I'm on Twitter a lot. It's Pauline Chow, my Twitter handle, or I do post the stories that are published on PaulineChowStories.com.
Mm-hmm. Great. And also I will follow up with you to link the books or the paper you mentioned in the show notes.
That's great.
Yeah. Thanks for coming to the Data Scientist Show and sharing your projects, your stories. And I think the audience can learn a lot from your experiences.
Oh yeah. I'm really glad you had me. And actually like a few of my short stories have like, are like a little bit fantasy, but horror, and it deals with like the office setting, because I know I find some little bit of hypocrisy. It's like, or funny stuff about the office too. Yeah. So then this might be a good audience for you to read some of those stories.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll check it out.
Okay. Thank you so much for having me. It was really nice to speak with you and get to know the content that you have too online.
Thank you.